Howdy and welcome to the show. Cooper's Code examines legal issues so we can all achieve the best results for our clients. Today, I'm privileged to sit down with the Honorable Rebecca Westerfield. Judge Westerfield, former Kentucky Circuit Court judge, joined JAMS, the shorthand name for the Judicial Arbitration and Mediation Services, in 1992 as a founder and full-time panelist. With 31 years of highline arbitration and mediation work under her belt, she has used discernment and curiosity, overseeing the sea change in alternative dispute resolution as the process helped people reach resolution. She is known for complex multi-party, multi-issue cases, and a go-to person for highly charged emotional cases. There's a reason Fortune 500 companies, multinational corporations, and those facing company and life-altering litigation seek out Judge Westerfield. Beyond her casework, she has taught international mediation programs in Asia, Europe, and Latin America, been an adjunct professor at the University of California Berkeley School of Law, and more recently been involved in work related to the conflict in the Ukraine. Please enjoy this episode with Judge Westerfield. Going straight into things in terms of background, what is it that originally drew you to the law?
Well, that's a very long story because I'll go back to when I was 10 years old and my father would take me to various political events throughout my teen years. And he was deeply politically involved, a good friend of Senator Wendell Ford of Kentucky. And as I looked around the room, it seemed to me everybody who seemed to be in charge were lawyers. I thought that might be a good thing to do, is to become a priest of the secular society there. That was really what inspired me to go into law. And then, of course, later became much more politically active and saw how important legislative acts were. I saw how important the law was in creating society. And so it was the perfect place to be for social change. And those were exciting years.
In terms of those being exciting years, approximately when are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about 1968 to 1972. So there was a lot going on. I was a student leader. I was very involved in the feminist movement. I worked with Gloria Steinem, among others. I was a founding member of the National Women's Political Caucus, which at the time I was, I think, the youngest member. I would look around the room and there would be Shirley Chisholm and Bella Abzug and Fannie Lou Hamer and all the really great women who led that movement to what it became.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a wonderful, heady experience for a young woman.
From there, did you stay involved in the political sphere or did you end up with a practice of some sort?
I was always involved politically. I went to Peace Corps. I was in West Africa for a while, came back, went to law school and got out of law school in about 2.5 years because I was in a bit of a hurry. We had in Kentucky passed a judicial article where we completely reformed our entire judicial system. So I was there on the ground with my mentor, Judge Pennington, and we totally reformed the judicial system in Kentucky and professionalized it. And it was, again, another heady experience of being there to see great change.
I know from personal experience, having a mentors that got me into the law were significant. Can you tell us a little bit about who this individual was and how they served as a mentor to you?
Well, Judge Pennington had great vision about what a judicial system should look like, that it should be professional. It shouldn't just be justices of the peace, that we really owed it to the public to give them a sense of confidence in the judiciary, which is why I've always had a long-time commitment to an independent judiciary. And he was just a wonderful leader in that way. In my law practice, there really weren't very many mentors. At the time I went to law school, only 17% of the class were women. So we were filling our way through, but we did have a women's law caucus, and I had many good friends who helped me through that time of challenge and trying to figure out what was gender-based and what wasn't. It was always a really important issue. And so to have your women friends whom you really trusted and who were highly professional and very successful themselves was actually key. We kind of all felt our way through the legal system. I was the first woman president of the Louisville Bar Association and enjoyed the support of some very well-intentioned men with great experience and guidance. And I'm grateful for that as well.
I'm laughing a little bit because the intonation you had with well-intentioned seemed like very careful word choice.
Well, sometimes they understood and sometimes they didn't, but at least they tried, and that was important. And I'll always be very grateful for those listening.
It's a different time now. We're, I think, closer to 50% in terms of the numbers of women and men who go to law school. And from my perspective, I've seen change. I know from being married to a woman who is a lawyer.
A very good lawyer, I might add.
Yes. That whether there has been change, there has not been enough change. And with your experience, seeing the changes over the years, do you have any views about how the progress that has been made and the progress that remains?
Well, I think there has to be a greater tolerance for a wider band of styles, less judgment about limiting women to certain styles, even speech patterns. I think that's still something that we need to work on and do deeper listening.
If there are young women in the law right now who are listening to this, do you have any recommendations to them in terms of your personal experience and how you were able to carve your path?
Well, again, I think that you need to have your friends, men and women, to help you have that sense of community and stability and reality as you feel your way through. So if you're a law student, pay attention who's sitting to your left and sitting to your right, because they may become your best friend and your colleague that you will rely on in the future. You're making your future now in the present. So that's the main message.
And coming at it from a different direction, for men, those of us who want to be allies in the profession, do you have any feedback on how one can best serve as an ally? You mentioned the well-intentioned folks, and I know that there are a lot of us men who want to help, and in doing so, start mansplaining about how here's the best way to do it.
Right. Corey, I think you're trying to say. Yes. Right.
Yes.
I know the help. Look, you have women that in your life that you have great respect for. I know that.
Yeah.
And so to use them to help you as you do a hard examination of how you communicate when you stop listening, I think it's always an interesting exercise to say to a man, when do you stop listening to a woman? I stop listening to a woman when? And also to have women say, I stop listening to men when? And it's a very interesting conversation. I highly recommend it for your next dinner party.
That may go on at dinner tonight at the house. I've never thought of it that way. That's fascinating.
And then it's step back and then listen. What did I miss?
Yeah. Going back to your involvement with the judiciary, at a certain point in your career, did you transition into being a judge yourself?
Yes, I was appointed by the first woman governor of Kentucky, Martha Lane Collins, and I had to run for that seat, which I handily won. And then there came a point in my life, I was one of the youngest judges in Kentucky at the time. And after serving for a while, I decided that I wanted to try something different and move to California. I had taken the California bar while I was on the bench, and I passed the bar happily the first time, although only one third of us who were taking the bar as members of other bars passed. I took it as a ticket to come out to California. This was in 1992. I had also been involved in the Clinton campaign, so I was involved in that campaign here in San Francisco, and I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I did not want to litigate, that much I knew. I knew I didn't want to move from California to Washington, so there was no consideration of moving to D.C. with the administration. So someone said to me, you should go see a guy named Danny Weinstein. And so I literally knocked on Danny's door one day, and Danny, being the very generous and inclusive person he is to this day, had me come in, started talking to me about this new organization that he and Coley Fannin, among others, had begun called JAMS, Judicial Arbitration Mediation Services. And he said, sure, why don't you just come on and join us? I thought, well, what is mediation? I really didn't even know what mediation was. So I literally had to retool myself. I went to every mediation program and training that I could find. Some of the great trainers like Linda Singer, Michael Lewis, and Bill Lincoln, and Gary Friedman, Jay Folberg, who later became part of JAMS as well, were just incredibly encouraging and knowledgeable. And so the rest is a 31-year history.
Am I right then that you were one of the founding members of JAMS?
Yes. Yes.
I also think back to that time. I started getting exposed to the law, not as a lawyer, but I started with Veeam back in 96. So that's 4 years after. And even then, while I was hearing about mediation, alternative dispute resolution and the whole process seemed to be very nascent. What was it like to be in kind of the groundswell movement of building this as a practice that has transformed litigation over the last 30 years?
It was a lot of hard work. We went to anywhere where there were more than two lawyers to talk about the difference between mediation and arbitration, which oddly is still confused by some people to this day. But we went through a process of having to really educate people on what mediation was, which is basically third-party facilitated negotiation, and what value a mediator could bring to the negotiation table, to a process that was different from settlement conferences and a process that had potential of providing better outcomes than court. The one thing I do want to emphasize about ADR and mediation in particular is it is only an alternative to the judiciary. And frankly, I think it's only as good as the strength of our independent judiciary. So that when we're talking about the alternative to the negotiated agreement, it's important that that alternative to negotiated agreement be something of integrity and substance as well. So I think it's very important for mediators and lawyers not to look at mediation, ADR, as a substitute, but purely complementary to the independent courts.
I'd love for you to expand on that, if you can, in terms of the importance of an independent judiciary, because that's, I think, twice that it has come up in the conversation so far. You talked about the changes that you worked with your mentor in terms of the Kentucky judiciary. Are there areas where an independent judiciary is threatened, as far as you're concerned?
I don't want to get too political in this, Miles, but I believe that we can see that all around us. And I think we need to have that third branch of government that at least puts a pause on sometimes highly controversial things going on and give everybody a deep breath and bring reason back to the conversation of whatever the issue might be. I think it's absolutely critical to a democracy. And had some highly publicized cases, and I would get calls from people who wanted to tell me what to do with the case. And I would explain to them that as a judge, you don't take a poll. One of my dearest friends and colleagues, when I became a judge, I asked her for advice, and she said, first of all, it's the best job in the world because the job description is do the right thing. And I think that's what every neutral ought to strive to do the right thing, to hold that center with a passion, if you will. I'm passionate about moderation. I think it's critical, and particularly in times of the kind of extremism that we see in our society today. And I mentioned to you earlier in our pre-session conversation, I just got back from Poland, where I was working with Danny Weinstein, and we were working with about 40 Polish judges and about 16 Ukrainian judges on this very issue of independent judiciary, how to maintain neutrality, how to provide a place where people feel heard, where they don't feel they have to engage in some sort of self-help around justice and vengeance and or whatever they felt that justice provides for them. And of course, we talked about mediation as also an alternative that helps those courts. Polish courts are inundated with cases coming from the refugee crisis, the Ukrainian judges, who, by the way, were not able to leave Ukraine when the war started. This was the first trip these judges had had outside Ukraine, was just last month. But they are so dedicated to wanting to maintain a civil and civic life where business can go on, where families can move on, where conflict can be resolved so that people can go about their ordinary daily lives. Most people don't want to be involved in conflict, and they just need help, and they need a safe place where they can resolve it.
That is important and powerful work, and not the first time that you've been involved in international work, correct?
Correct.
And in terms of following that thread a little bit, I know from reading your bio that you've done work in various places in terms of working with organizations, I think, on every continent other than Antarctica.
Yes, and I'm going to Antarctica in December, so we'll see.
It's obvious that that's a passion for you, because it certainly goes beyond the work that you do on day-to-day work as a mediator and arbitrator and neutral. Why do you do that, and what drew you to it?
Well, because, again, I believe that most people don't want to be in conflict. I think there are better ways to use resources than litigation when possible, although I do want to emphasize again, there are times when litigation is absolutely necessary, and certainly respect that. And so it's important to help, particularly, I think, in these cross-cultural situations, to find the common language, to find a place where there can be genuine, authentic communication. People are people around the world. There are cultural differences, obviously. I did programs in India with the Supreme Court there, with their high court. They're people. They're professionals. The judges want, again, to make sure that the citizens of their country feel that they have alternatives to conflict itself, particularly to violent conflict.
One of the pieces that I've found interesting as I've seen individuals like you, and you mentioned Jay Fulberg, I think of him as Dean Fulberg.
Yes.
There are a lot of individuals who are leaders in your field, yourself included, who find themselves in these international roles, Judge Weinstein being another. And the question that I have is, I think of some of this as almost being State Department or negotiations between highly conflicted cultures. And I find it interesting how people who are involved in something so local that I can be sitting across from you find themselves in a role where they're able to affect change at that level.
Well, I don't know if it's affecting change, but I certainly want to create the possibility for change. There are well over 100 senior fellows from literally all over the world. And we have had some very personal conversations with some of our fellows who are in areas of conflict and war as we speak. Again, trying to assure them that their faith in peaceful, nonviolent conflict resolution is not misplaced, and that we need to support that. We need not to lose hope in that possibility. And it's very difficult for obvious reasons when there is real violent conflict surrounding.
As we record this, the Israel-Gaza conflict has been going on for almost a month now. Ukraine-Russia has been going on for far longer. And those are just the big high-level news conflicts that are going on, and there are conflicts all over. It is a challenging time to discuss peaceful negotiation when one sees that level of violence.
That's true. That it's at a very high level, right? That's at the nation-state level. That being said, I've been in conversation with many of our fellows who are in those places of conflict. I mentioned the Ukrainian judges as well. People want to get on with their daily life as much as possible. to the extent that there is any capacity for having a normal life under such circumstances, they want to do it and they need help doing it, particularly with the trauma that's involved. And I think it's important to continue to encourage people to keep hope, to live their lives, to do the best they can under incredible and sometimes horrific circumstances.
You do both mediation and arbitration, and I know that there are a lot of neutrals who focus solely on mediation. Why do you do both?
Well, I believe I can offer a service. I mentioned before that I really believe in the power of neutrality. And as an arbitrator, I try to do the right thing. I try to get it right, try to give the parties the forum that they chosen. It's very gratifying to be able to, again, help people take some situation and put it behind them.
Do you find yourself doing more of one than the other?
Post-COVID, I'm doing more arbitrations, and I'm not sure why that is. I don't know if there's more of a need for it, but it certainly seems that there are more arbitrations, at least on my docket, since COVID.
COVID is a good topic for us to spin into the world of Zoom versus live.
Right.
Pre-pandemic, if you were told that the highly charged emotional cases that you work on were going to suddenly be done via a video screen, would you have believed that you would have been able to be as effective as it has turned out that we've had to be given the circumstance?
Pre-COVID, I wouldn't have thought that it would work. Post-COVID, we see that it actually does. Now, in terms of satisfaction level, for me as a mediator, I'd much rather see people in person. My friend Danny once introduced me to a group as a humanist who understands numbers, which I think is key for any good mediator. You have to understand the numbers, but you also have to understand people. I just enjoy the five senses. I enjoy being able to share space with folks. So I miss that piece. That being said, I am surprised sometimes at how intimate Zoom can be. And I don't know if it's because of the camera, maybe ask your producer here, or whether you're able to see things that you might otherwise miss if you were in person because you're distracted by other things. And that camera is very, very revealing. So it can be very powerful. On the other hand, I think one of the downsides of Zoom, and I'd love your thoughts on this, Miles, is that I think it's a little bit too comfortable for folks. And so it's a little bit too easy for them to say no to a reasonable agreement. And it takes a little bit longer. It takes a little bit more follow-up on occasion. I would highly recommend, as I know you do, plaintiff's attorneys in particular, I think, ought to have their client in the room with them or be in the room at their home or wherever, but be together. I think that's really pretty important.
The question about it being easier to say no, I haven't noticed that in the same way. And I think we've had a reasonably high success rate with resolution, not always at the mediation itself. Oftentimes it is a mediator's proposal or a diligent mediator doing the work, or the mediation is, you probably don't like the first dance phrase in terms of mediations, but the idea that you get together and while the parties are eager to resolve things, it becomes clear that certain work needs to be done, questions need to be answered before people can get to resolution. And so whether you call it a first dance or a learning mediation, the diligent mediator who follows through, I find whether I've been in person, and that has not happened that often, or via Zoom, we've been able to get most of them closed.
Well, I do think there is value in a first step mediation for sure, at least for folks to realize that, well, they need more and more piece of information or there's another piece of the process that they need to go through. I think it's very important, critical for the mediator after a mediation of that type to leave things on a very hopeful note. Not that this has been a failed mediation, but something's been learned, even again, if it's the next step that needs to be taken. That being said, I would also say, Miles, that I think you and Marianne, your firm, does a very good job of preparing your clients for the mediation process. I think they have a very high level of confidence in you. So I think that also that pre-mediation work that lawyers do with their clients, to help manage their clients' expectations is absolutely key. I don't like using the word client control because that sounds just a little too manipulative, but I think having client interaction and authentic relationship and with the client understanding that you're trying to do the best for them is key.
I appreciate the feedback. The experience we've had with the firms that I've been with is that that's just always how it's been done. That if you want your client to go into the mediation process and have a successful outcome, that doesn't necessarily mean a settlement, but a successful outcome from the mediation, they have to know what to expect and they have to feel empowered. And that requires the preparation work.
Right. Well, I think also it requires looking at that person as a person and not just it's a broken leg or it's whatever it is under some heading as a case, but to look at the individuals. And I think that's the difference between good litigators and litigators who are less effective, quite frankly, is to really look at the particular. And by the way, that's whether it's on the plaintiff side or the defense side. There can be individual defendants who have their own personal issues. They need to be understood. They need to be heard. And it's just as important on that side. I am still quite honestly surprised at the number of times that I may ask a question of clients or parties and find out things about them that their attorneys don't even know. It's more common than you might imagine because that would not happen to you and your clients.
You say that, and the immediate response I had when you brought that up is, I think there's a reason why you have been so successful doing what you do. And part of that is you have an inquisitive nature and a depth that is different than many others. And I think I've seen you have engagements with our clients where I think in certain respects, outside of their lawyer, it is the first time they have felt heard in a deep and meaningful way.
Well, I want to give credit to Gary Friedman for that. Gary is a well-known leader of mediation, certainly in the early years. And Gary talked a lot about staying out of judgment. And when I find that I'm moving into judgment and I have to be very thoughtful about that, the antidote to that is curiosity, and that's really the fun of it. It's like, wait a minute, maybe I'm missing something. Let's go back to where I made some sort of judgment. Now, let's be clear. I have to add some value to the process. So discernment is a virtue, but it's a little different than just putting someone in a box and then not hearing from them or hearing only from them if they confirm your judgment. That is not helpful to the process.
We feel a lot of comfort in going to mediation with the mediators that we choose to work with. And I've seen lawyers where there is resistance to someone like you, the mediator, having a deep, meaningful conversation with the client. There is concern about a loss of client control or something coming forward that the lawyer hadn't prepared for. At the same time, our experience with that is it can really lay the groundwork for a successful resolution. Do you run into trouble or challenges with lawyers who stiff-arm you and say, no, the questions come to me?
I totally respect that, particularly if they haven't worked with me before. Why would they trust me? That's fair, totally fair. So, no, I work with the lawyers, and they have their own special relationship with the clients. I do not interfere with attorney-client relationships. That being said, there are some attorneys who want me to work with the clients. There are some attorneys who don't want me to work with the clients. That's their choice. I have to respect that. They know their relationship better than I do. And there may be reasons for that that I will never know, by the way. I am well aware of the fact that I probably only see the tip of the iceberg of all of the relationships and the full story and all the rest of it. That being said, yeah, from my perspective, it's much more satisfying to have that real authentic connection, but that's not always possible. And there may be reasons, as I said, for it that are very good reasons that the attorney makes the call on. And I have to respect that. I think as a mediator, we also have to respect giving attorneys the space to do what they need to do, to advocate, to make their arguments. And by the way, sometimes they may make arguments that they're not really all that convinced of themselves, but they need their client to hear that they made the argument. And I think we have to respect that.
That makes sense. I want to go back several levels. And one of the comments you made about Zoom or video mediations was the camera and the impact of the camera. And one of the things I've noticed in video meetings is, and I'm trying to figure out how to say this without sounding odd or creepy, the camera allows one to focus on someone else in a way that you can't in a normal environment. And what I mean by that is you can stare at somebody on one of those communications in a way where you can't, or you would seem off otherwise. And I've found that I can learn more about people under certain circumstances through that method. And when you were referring to the camera piece, was that an element of what you were referring to, or were you referring to something different?
I think that's right. I think that you see it in good acting, right? They get the facials, they get what it is they're trying to communicate without words. That being said, the other thing that I've learned over the years, sometimes the hard way, is check in on your assumptions. So something may be said, and then you get a reaction, perhaps a negative facial reaction from the person. If you're going to use that as a piece of information, you need to check that out. For all you know, they just had a back tweak. Something may have happened in the background. Who knows? Because you can't start building stories and create stories that may not otherwise exist.
How would you do that?
Well, it depends. I might ask the question a different way to see if I get the same reaction or impatience or frustration. I may sometimes just say, I just saw you raise your eyebrow. Is there something in particular I need to address here so I can understand what's of concern to you and what's important to you? I mean, do it in a way that's inviting a conversation, not trying to cut somebody off or make any judgment about their reaction.
We talked a little bit about mediations where it is the beginning of a process, meaning it doesn't resolve there, but it goes forward. I know mediators sometimes refer to cases as orphans. I don't know if that's the phrase you use. How do you track cases for follow-up when it hasn't resolved and the parties have indicated that they still want you to help them?
Well, let me just say, first of all, none of my cases are orphans. I always follow through. I'm always the hovering helicopter parent, if you will, yeah. Trying to see, is the time right to come back yet? And I tell folks sometimes when we either they have an assignment, something's going to happen, I'm going to call them again in a couple of months, or they want to have another session in a couple of months, or after a deposition's taken or something of that sort. And I will otherwise tell them, I'm going to be calling you out of the blue. It doesn't mean the other parties asked me to call you or anything of that sort. I'm just trying to find out, has anything changed? Is there a moment here for an opening for a conversation? Because, as you know, Miles, once you get into litigation, you're in a different space, and it's very hard to pull back and say, wait a minute, maybe we ought to have another look at a possibility of conversation here and a different way of resolving the conflict. My friend Danny Weinstein talks about litigation sometimes. He says it's like a helium balloon that just kind of goes out of control. So we try to keep a little bit of a string on it, bring it back for conversation and examination, reevaluation.
I think those of us in a rational moment who, on the litigation side, would say that they are very appreciative of that and that none of us want things to spin out of control. And yet, despite everyone's best efforts, you sometimes just have those cases.
Right. They take a life of their own.
Yeah. Or situations where you get along like gas and matches with the other side.
Yeah. Well, that's a good time to bring in a mediator if that's the issue.
Well, that's an opening for a question. When the case is unable to resolve and one gets into the ego flare, that it's just combat, it's law in motion, it's no you did, kindergarten involvement. Do you get brought back into those cases?
Sometimes, and sometimes I again will press to reinsert myself in the case, because a case shouldn't go forward just because the lawyers can't get along with one another, right? It's understandable that a case may go forward because the parties can't get along. But again, that's for the professional lawyers and for mediators to help them work through whatever needs to be worked through on the emotional side to get to a place of a well-reasoned and smart resolution.
That seems like a good opportunity to talk a little bit about ethics and civility in the practice, which I know is a topic that comes up regularly. When I first started, I was in a space where there was an individual who rented an office, a guy named Roy Rice. And I don't know if you ever came across Leroy Rice.
No, but I did come across Melvin Belli.
Okay, well, Roy, Melvin Belli, those were all, I would say, lions of the bar and peers, and engaged in a bare-knuckled engagement that is different than what one sees today. And yet at the same time, oftentimes would go and have drinks with each other after they beat on each other all day long.
Right.
You see the beating, and then you don't see the hanging out afterwards in certain respects. At the same time, it seems like some of the aspects of civility have improved. And that's a launchpad for you to provide your observations as somebody who has been around for a long time.
Well, I'm not sure I see quite that difference. I still see quite a bit of conflict between attorneys. And again, it's a question of managing it. Sometimes I'll get attorneys in the room and we'll work through it because they're essentially want to see the best outcome for their client. And they're mature enough to see that their own personal disagreement is not in their client's best interest. All right, they just need a space to do that. On the other hand, I've also seen those sort of situations where, yes, they're yelling at one another and it feels good to them. And then they realize, okay, we got that over with. Now let's get to work and roll up our sleeves and let's resolve the case. So that's where the experienced mediator can hopefully come in and help manage that situation one way or the other and come up with, you know, let's get this meeting going, or why is this person doing that? What's the issue? I've had situations where I've been surprised sometimes by the level of emotion that I might get from an attorney that I would not expect. And then I find out the day before yesterday, they found out their wife has breast cancer, right? There are other things working them, and then give them a chance to take the deep breath, move forward with what's in front of us, which is their client's case. So it's sort of creating that trust where you can really figure out what's really going on here. Is this show? Is it tactic? Is it strategy? Or is there something else at work?
I go back to the words that you used not very long ago of curiosity and discernment.
Exactly.
It sounds like those two tools can help you parse that piece out.
Exactly.
Is it something different that's underlying, or is this actual friction between the parties?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you're trying to examine and figure out and then work with it one way or the other. And by the way, sure, there are some cases that just need to be tried, and that's fine. And I think that's important, but I don't give up easily.
That was where I was going to go next with that, is I sometimes tell our clients that everyone has an ego in the mediation process. Mm-hmm. And we want to get the best result possible for you. The other side wants to get the best possible result for their client. And the mediator, their ego piece, and no offense to the profession, but another notch on the belt in terms of, I was able to resolve that case too. And that one was very complicated. And so a win is different for each person.
Right. And of course, we do what we call the mediation dance when the case actually resolves. It's very exciting and it's very fulfilling. And I've had some wonderful exchanges with parties even after a mediation is long gone, and they'll come back and write me a note about how relieved they are, or they didn't even realize what a burden they had been under, and they feel renewed. And that is extremely satisfying. I think the important thing for the mediator to do is to look at the impasse. What is the impasse? Is it folks really believe they're going to get something better at trial? Maybe. Does it have to do with the number? Does it have to do with some interest, some emotion? There may be some business consideration that we don't even know until I can dig down a little deeper and find out there's other issues here that are in the background. So the main thing, I think, for the mediator is not to force a resolution, but to make sure that every conceivable possible issue has been examined and re-examined to make sure that there is no further place for discussion. And quite frankly, it rarely happens that there is absolutely no place for further discussion.
I want to go back to conflict and people yelling at each other, and that sometimes they just need to yell at each other and then they get down to business. Do you sometimes have a situation where, whether it's Zoom or in person, where you know that you're going to be bringing people together and that's what's going to happen for a while? That's just who these people are?
Oh, I'm very, very careful with that. First of all, I don't expose parties to that. And I will ask the attorneys, is there something you want to say to the other side? Is there something that we just need to get out and, you know, set it up so it's not destructive? I do think it's interesting that many mediators are conflict avoidant. And I think by being conflict avoidant, they don't understand the conflict. And that means that they can come to inauthentic superficial impasse because they haven't really dug underneath to see what this conflict is really about. But I think you have to do it very surgically and very, very carefully. And it takes an enormous amount of trust building for it to be at all effective.
When you talk about impasse, I feel typically at a mediation, you know, you get a few moves, you know, round one, round two, round three, sometimes you get to four or five, and then that's when things start.
Sometimes I've gone to 10, 15. I mean, it seems silly in some ways, but it's necessary to some people, and that's fine. They don't feel like they've gotten the best deal until they've had 15 moves. That's fine.
Well, I'm thinking about, though, where impasse first shows its head. And typically for me, I see that typically around move three or move four, where one side or the other doesn't have faith in the process, doesn't trust the other, feels insulted by the moves, or recognizes it's not going the way they want it to. And so things seize up. And that's when I sometimes jokingly say, okay, this is why you get the big bucks.
Yeah, right.
You need to fix this problem.
Right.
And when that happens, what tools do you like to employ? And I know that it's going to vary wildly based on the case.
Well, first of all, impasse doesn't happen very often in my cases. It happens at the end. That being said, are there moments within the process of the meeting itself in which I think, oh, this case is not ready for resolution? That happens at least once or twice in the tough mediations. And then again, you work through it, you figure out, where did we go off the rails? What do we need to re-examine? And sometimes it's just a disruptive factor of literally just taking a break. I've had cases where I've taken either a lawyer and sometimes a party with the lawyer's permission, only with the lawyer's permission, for a walk. Literally, just break it up. Get some fresh air because people have become rutted in some way. I've seen my friend Danny, and I'm sure you've seen it with others as well, who also use humor as a disruptive factor. And you have to be very, very careful with that, right? Because you don't want to seem disrespectful to the parties or to the process. But just that little bright, fresh air sometimes can really help people get unstuck for the moment, step back, take a pause, re-examine, listen a little more deeply.
What is the video equivalent of taking somebody for a walk?
Going into a separate room with attorney's agreement, of course, changing the subject, asking a different question, trying to get a little bit more background, acknowledging what's going on, say, we seem to be stuck, let's work together, let's get past it. That sort of authentic conversation. I think people feel it. And I do think it's the responsibility, and I do think this is very important. It is the responsibility of the mediator that in those moments, it be an authentic conversation, not a manipulative one. Because, first of all, I think people sense if it's manipulative. And secondly, I think it can do more harm than good. I think it really has to be as authentic and real as possible. Does it mean that all information is out at that point, understood? Maybe a different kind of conversation, but at least it's something where someone feels they're really connected with another human being who's trying to help them through this process. And I would say that's particularly true in the terrible, catastrophic personal injury cases. I think it's critical.
I listened to a podcast recently, an interview of Chris Voss, who wrote Never Split the Difference, which is one of the books that various people read on negotiation. One of the things he talked a lot about in hostage negotiation, because that's where he came from, was mirroring. And the way he defined mirroring was, I would say, a deep listening tool, but it involved a lot of almost repetition of the previous person's sentence with a reflection back to make sure that that person was heard.
Well, reflective listening has long been a tool of mediators, for sure. I get a little concerned if it's just parroting. That being said, sometimes that is necessary because the words have been so critical, the exact words have been so critical to the party that you want to make sure they know you heard that word, and then you add to it a reflective listening that frames the comment differently, re-languages it in a way. And it's also a way of being able to get a sense of whether or not they're capable of listening. And they may not at that point, and that's fine. That's what they have a lawyer for.
As I'm sitting here, I'm thinking about the decades of experience you have doing this work and what I would probably describe as unconscious competence in terms of being able to be a deep listener. And I would use the phrase deploy listening tactics and conversation skills where you aren't even aware of how deft you are in making people feel heard and how some of these tools used by others where it could come across as manipulative if people were trying to use something like a newly learned technique out of a book.
I think that it's important to stay present. It's very important. And look, it's hard. You do this 5 days a week, and it's hard to stay present every single moment. And I think you have to be discerning about that too, right? There are times when folks need to do what they need to do. You let them do it, right? Their pre-recorded messages, whatever it is that they want to put forth here for that kernel of truth or importance that might be in it, but also to preserve your energy for the moment when it really matters.
I find sometimes the energy that I expend to be completely present can be draining by the end of the day.
Absolutely. Can be exhausting.
And sometimes it can be, I think of the extrovert-introvert issues. You know, extroverts get fulfilled by crowds, introverts get depleted by crowds. Does being present fulfill you in a way, even if it consumes energy, does it fulfill you in a way that keeps you coming back?
Yeah, it's the authenticity. If at the end of the day, something authentic has happened here, someone has come to a resolution that is, again, liberating to them, or it's the best that could be gotten or done or achieved in the mediation, and everyone's done their best, that is a good day, and I am not drained. I can be there till 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. That doesn't happen anymore, by the way. That is one change in mediation. We used to do that all the time, but it seems as though attorneys have gotten a little bit more efficient, I think. But in any event, it's really the authenticity that gives the energy, for me at least. Even if it's authentic enough to say, this is not the moment, this is not the time, let's do this another day, let's have another conversation, again, leaving it on that high note of there is hope yet.
You talked about how it doesn't happen with the same regularity of going late into the evening. As we examine some of the things that happened in mediation and its history, I remember early mediations that I had the privilege of going to when I was, even before law school, I had the opportunity to go and see some of these. And back then, a lot of times, things would start in joint caucus. there might be a presentation from one side or the other. And it seemed like there was a bit of showmanship with some mediators that was involved in, I would say, working the mediation process. Of late, that seems to never happen. And my question is, did you ever have that kind of joint caucus approach and then move away from it? Or have you seen similar changes in the field?
I think the joint caucus has to have a purpose. And sometimes the purpose, again, is just for the client to see that their attorney have made all the arguments that the client wants them to make. And I think if they want to use the joint caucus for that purpose, sometimes I have to beg the other side to permit that to happen. But I tell them it's a matter of process satisfaction. Give the attorney the opportunity, whether it makes a difference in how you view the case or not. Let's just have this moment. Maybe that happens. Sometimes we'll have a joint caucus, particularly if it's a highly complex business case. And I do a lot of Silicon Valley corporation cases and fraud cases and so on. We have forensic accounting. In situations like that, I think it's really important to make sure that everybody understands the same information or can agree to disagree on a particular point. And some of this is very nuanced and very complicated. So if there's a purpose for the joint session, I think it's critical to have it for process satisfaction. Do I have it in every case? No. How often do I have it? Frankly, I couldn't even tell you. And it might happen at a different point in the process. It might happen mid-afternoon rather than first thing in the morning. I did have a really sad case. It was a young woman who had been killed in a crosswalk by a muni bus. And very difficult. The parents were shattered, absolutely shattered. She was extremely talented. And her mother, in particular, had an extremely difficult time with this death and was insistent on wanting to talk to the city. And so I had city attorneys involved. This is a mediation that actually had about, I think, maybe three different sessions. And we're still getting stuck. And finally, I said to the city attorney, can we have the head of Muni come to the joint session? And of course, as you know, there are unfortunately a lot of Muni cases, so he does not come to all sessions. But given this was a death case, and I thought it could really, really help, because this mother did not want her daughter to have died in vain. She wanted to have some sense that something had been learned, and she needed that audience in order to close the case. So convinced the city to do this. The manager came, and the father was just devastated. He hardly spoke. The mother showed the various photo albums, her artwork, and so on. And as a parent, you certainly could appreciate just the pure grief of that loss. And I looked over to the head of Muni, and I had said to him, you don't need to say anything. You just need to listen. And after he heard that, he said to her, that was my first day as the director of Muni, my first day. The attorneys didn't even know that. No one knew that. And he talked about how devastating it was, how he would never want it to happen to anybody ever again, how he would dedicate himself to safety. It meant everything for this woman, everything for her. At that point, she could hand the case over to her highly competent plaintiff's attorney to negotiate around the numbers, which is a different conversation, but it enabled her to let go that her daughter had had her death honored in some way and seen and recognized, and it meant something.
It sounds like an incredibly powerful moment.
It was. It really was.
It brings to mind a piece. I've been exposed to some work where the goal in resolution goes beyond the exchange of money and the conclusion of the case. It seems to happen somewhat infrequently, and it seems to happen primarily in fatality cases. And on the plaintiff's side, it can be transformative in terms of, I don't want to say being able to let go, because I don't know that anyone ever lets go.
Right.
But in terms of having a sense of closure and that the other side truly gets it, not just writes a check, but gets it. And it is neat to hear that that kind of work is being done.
Yeah. Well, it's authentic recognition. And again, that's the sweet moment. That's the most powerful moment in mediation.
And with that, I'd like to turn a little bit to, we ran into each other a week ago at the BenchBar conference, and the focus there was on artificial intelligence. Everyone, it seems, these days, is offering AI product or conversations about AI and how it's going to impact a particular field. And I found the experience interesting. One, I found it interesting just in terms of the number of judges who were at the BenchBar conference and who it was evident that it was important to them to participate and hear. I was curious what your takeaway was from the conversation, either there or with AI, in terms of where you see things impacting our field, particularly in your role.
First of all, that was the San Francisco Bar Association.
Thank you.
Bench Bar Conference on Artificial Intelligence. I found it fascinating. I, like you, was very impressed by the number of judges who were there, who were engaged, who clearly understand the implications of artificial intelligence. Conversely, I was surprised there were so few lawyers there, because this is going to change how we do lawyering. There's just absolutely no question about it. What work will be done by AI? What work will be done by the lawyers? What task will be accomplished by AI? What is it that attorneys will need to continue to do is something yet to be determined, that's for sure. And then, of course, there's the predictive analysis issue. I don't know where an AI vendor would get information about mediations and how they resolve so that they could do anything that would provide any sort of predictive analysis in mediation itself. JAMS has not kept that data for confidential reasons. Obviously, we don't report how cases settle or what they settle for. But that being said, certainly the alternative negotiated agreement verdicts are, I'm sure, being analyzed as we speak with regards to predictive analysis. What were the factors beyond the lawyers? Was there anything in this process that can lead to some sort of predictive analysis? So I think that's going to be a really important tool in the future, but extremely complicated.
Very complicated. And one of the pieces that I think AI does not take into account has consumed a lot of our conversation, which is the emotional engagement required in the deep work that is done. And I'm thinking particularly in mediation. The curiosity and discernment that you bring to mediation obviously helps with people being able to tell their story and feel heard. Do you use those same tools in arbitration? And if so, do they differ in any way and how?
Well, no, I don't use those tools because the attorneys have to present the evidence. So I don't certainly engage in any use of mediation tools in arbitration. I do bring my curiosity. I do try to figure out, what's the real story here? What really happened? Who's been injured? Why? What's really at play? Try to get the facts straight as much as humanly possible and then apply the law. I think it's interesting about parties and using this opportunity to think aloud a bit about artificial intelligence. If we get to a point that there's a predictive analysis that's pretty good, really good, I think for some parties that will be a relief. In other words, their feeling of being vindicated in some way, or that they've made the most of the process, or they're no longer victimized, or they're not overpaying, or whatever, they may be willing to hand over that decision-making to AI, and there'd be less emotion. It's easier just to say, well, I have confidence in this tool. And again, I'm a femme de certain âge, so I'm an older generation. This younger generation's going to be much more comfortable with handing over decision-making to these predictive tools.
So will we be seeing James Soon, the Judicial Artificial Intelligence Mediation Service?
I think that's a great name. At some point, it's definitely going to have an impact. And I think it's just naive to think that this is just an ordinary tool. I think it's something more than that as well, which we need to really look at hard in terms of how it regenerates. It's iterative, as they say, and to make sure that we're not baking in inequality in some way or injustice in some way. So these are huge, huge issues that I think folks are going to be wrestling with, lawyers and engineers, for at least the next decade.
Which brings us back to big picture societal impact, which in certain respects is where we started in terms of your involvement with the feminist movement and the independent judiciary.
Right. I mean, at what point in the use of AI or whatever decision making we turn over to AI for convenience purposes needs to be checked by human intervention, human agency, human thought, because remember, AI doesn't think, AI calculates. And that's the big issue, right? Will it become sentient? Will it start thinking? And that's something we don't know yet either. And it would take quite a strong and confident human being to say, I don't agree with what AI is telling us we need to do in this particular program at this particular moment.
That will be an interesting future as we get to play out, if it becomes predictive in that way.
Right.
I don't see the trial courts going anywhere anytime soon, no matter how good AI gets. And we will, I think, start to see the differential between being predictive and then the outcome.
Right. Fascinating.
It is.
We should write an episode for Black Mirror on this.
It's a great idea. Well, Tricia Westerfield, thank you for taking the time and being willing to come on the show and share all the information that you did.
Well, thank you, Miles. It's been a delight. I appreciate the opportunity to think out loud about some of these really interesting issues.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Likewise. And thank you for listening today. Please email us at podcast@coopers.law with questions, comments, feedback, and suggestions on ways that you've approached alternative dispute resolution. Like what you heard? Share us with a colleague and leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. To all of you doing justice out there, happy hunting.